Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What sort of literary year was 2014? Despite the evanescent temptations of our digital devices, plenty of us make significant time for reading, so that coming to the end of a great book fills us with both fond regret and real excitement about moving on to whatever is next on the nightstand. My guests today read for a living, and they join us to offer their opinions as to some of the best books published this year. Randy Mayu is a professional speaker and writer and host of the First Friday Book Synopsis series, which focuses on business bestsellers. Michael Mershel is books editor for the Dallas Morning News, and Joy Tipping is a book reviewer for the Dallas Morning News. Welcome, all of you, to Think.
Thank you so much.
Glad to be here.
So when I say best books of 14, I really want to talk about stuff that you found interesting or important or worthy of recommending. But just to give everybody some perspective, will you each talk briefly about what you read when you're not reading for work and just want to enjoy a book?
Well, I'll start off, and I can say that I'm one of those readers who likes to dip into a little bit of everything, which means I know a great deal about I know very little about a great deal of things.
I can totally relate to that.
Yeah, I think reading is much too personal to have it be, even with my job, to have it be focused in one particular genre or one particular, you know, if all you do is read stuff because you have to, I think you lose something essential in your soul. So I like to dip into a great many things, and I'm very lucky that, probably like you are, there's just a constant flood of fantastic books flowing past us every day.
It gets a little depressing that you can't read them all.
It's very frustrating, and I feel like there's the guy from that old Twilight Zone episode who ends up the world ends, but he's it takes the end of the world before he can have enough time to read all the books he wants to read. And of course, being the Twilight Zone, spoiler alert, he breaks his glasses. I always fear about that. So,
all right, that was Mike Mershel. What about you, Randy?
Well, when I don't read business books, my real escape reading is I reread Nero Wolfe, and currently I'm working through Daniel Silva. I'm loving the Gabriel Allon series. But I've got many sample pages loaded on my Kindle app, and I listen to you, your interviews, and I have found wonderful books that are nonfiction generally that I hear on KERA, either with you or another program. And one that I loved this year was Five Came Back. It's about five Hollywood directors, and that was just a wonderful read. And that wasn't for business. It was just sheer pleasure. So that's what I do for pleasure.
How about you, Joy Tipping?
I would agree with Mike. I'm very ecumenical and voracious in my reading. And I always, it's funny because I remember when I was younger, I thought I had to finish a book before I started the next one. It was sort of a religion for me. But now I usually have at least two going. I'll have a nonfiction and a fiction. And I tend to gravitate toward thrillers and things with a little bit of an edge. Like, I was very proud that when Gone Girl became such a huge hit, I had already read Gillian Flynn's other two novels, which are much darker and edgier than Gone Girl, although that's hard to imagine. And I also love memoir. So I read a lot of memoir when I'm not reading fiction. Or I'm lucky because Mike has a carefully crafted cadre of reviewers, and he sort of knows what we're all good at and what we all love. So generally speaking, if I'm reviewing a book, it's a book I would have read anyway. So I never really think of it as work, because it's almost always something I would have read anyway.
We actually had Sue Monk Kidd on this year to talk about the invention of wings based on your review, which you said caused Mike to not allow you to use the word perfect anymore.
That is correct. I used the word perfect it was a book following that. I used the word perfect in that review, and then I used it again for Nancy Horan's book, Under the Wide and Starry Sky, which was probably my favorite fiction book of the year. But he came to me and said, okay, I'm putting a moratorium on the word perfect. You can't use that anymore.
So, in your defense, I'd say both of those books I've seen on a couple of end of year best lists. Both of those. So you weren't the only one who liked them a lot.
Yes.
So Under the Wide and Starry Sky is a fictionalized account of a real life relationship between Robert Louis Stevenson and his wife, who is actually the main character.
Exactly. And Nancy Horan is sort of credited with establishing this genre of woman behind the man stories. Her first book was Loving Frank, which was about Frank Lloyd Wright and his mistress, Mamie Borthwick Cheney, who he built Taliesin for. And there was a horrible tragedy at Taliesin. I don't want to give it away, but I had no idea. And I remember when I got to that point in the book going, oh my God, is that true? And I ran to Google. So in the review, I said, don't Google them because you're going to find out something you don't want to know. But when I interviewed her this year, she said she did, you know, she did not invent that genre. That was around a long time ago. She just sort of popularized it. And there have been several other books, you know, that have been bestsellers that are sort of the same kind of thing.
The Paula McLean book.
Right. About Hadley. The Paris Cunningham. Wife. Mm-hmm. There was one about Poe. There's one called Mrs. Poe that's about Edgar Allan Poe's wife. There have been several. But Under the Wide and Starry Sky is just a luminous, wonderful read. I mean, I just gulped it. Once I started reading it, I was, you know, staying up all night, doing all-nighters like I did in college because I just wanted to finish that book. I loved it so much.
All right, guys, you both mentioned the Walter Isaacson book, The Innovators, as being a really important book this year. Tell me about it.
From my perspective, and Michael is the book reviewer, I'm a book summarizer and synopsis person. And so, number one, I did not know all of the details of the history of the invention of the first gigantic computer and then the journey to the transistor and the microchip and the personal computer. So to me, it was a history fill-in with very good detail about the people that did it and the struggles they had. I'd read Steve Jobs presented that earlier. When I say present, I do synopses in front of audiences. And so I thought The Innovators was the logical next step. Here's the big Steve Jobs story. Now let's give the backstory on the others. I don't comment on how well written it is, but I will admit that Steve Jobs was a more fun read than The Innovators. But I felt like the information was incredibly valuable.
And I wouldn't dispute any of that. I liked The Innovators quite a bit, and in fact, it's the kind of book that you know that I could see if you've got an engineer in the family, and you always buy them that one big thick book that they're going to read for you know as their Christmas present. I would recommend it for that. I think the narrative was a little choppy. I was frustrated with it because Steve Jobs and Einstein. Which are remarkable biographies and have epic sweeps to them. This one kind of goes in fits and starts, but some of those segments are absolutely spectacular. The introduction talks about Ada Lovelace, whom I knew only as an icon, and to know her entire story as basically the woman who invented the concept of a computer, 100 years before her time. There's all kinds of Dallas history in there. You know, yes. Everybody knows that Texas Instruments had something to do with transistors. I think that's the everybody in Dallas knows. Okay, yeah, transistors came from here, but Bill Hagerty, right? Isaacson makes the case that he was the Steve Jobs of his day. You know, without him, without Dallas, without Texas Instruments, you don't have a transistor radio.
Yeah,
you don't.
And one of the real highlights was discovering that the first transistor radio hit at the moment that Elvis Presley hit. Hmm. And so you go from families listening to radios in the living room to teenagers listening to Elvis. And so it was kind of the birth of rebellion. And that was a very interesting little tidbit in the book, The Innovators.
Then it's full of stuff like that. So I think if you've got anybody who if you are somebody who enjoys learning how things work, if you use a computer, if you program a computer, it was a remarkable read in that sense.
Willful Blindness is your favorite book of the year, Randy?
Yes, it actually came out a couple of years earlier. I presented it in mid-year. And in fact, I'm doing a presentation on ethics that greatly comes from this again this week. Margaret Heffernan studied the intentional willful blindness of companies and people to things that are going wrong, and they're blind to it. And it starts with Libby Montana and the W.R. Grace story and toxic mining. And it has example after example. And what she says is, you know, kind of forget the Bernie Madoff. There are bad people in the world. But what happens is people see things going wrong, and then they become unseeing on purpose.
This sounds really relevant this year,
given
all of the questions we're asking about the way police departments are run in this country.
That's exactly right. And she taught me in reading the book that it was not just that people close their eyes, but sometimes they're exhausted and they miss things. Or sometimes they are doing so many things that they miss things. Or sometimes they're so far removed from decision makers that they can't get the message of warning up the track. And so all of that was very useful as you think about police departments and as you think about explosions where people see something that can go wrong, but they're not able to get the message out. So I think it ought to be mandatory reading for anybody making decisions that remotely touches ethics.
We don't do a lot of novels on this show because I feel really strongly that you have to read every word, whereas you can maybe skim a nonfiction book. But one that we did this year that I really found interesting was Emily St. John Mandel's Station 11.
Yes, and Mike interviewed her. I've read the book, and it's a fascinating book. It's my favorite, and I love dystopian, the whole dystopian novel
in a
genre.
Really different way, though.
But it's very, very different, and I love it because I have a theater background, and it's about a troupe of traveling Shakespearean actors who sort of become the mummers, you know, from the Middle Ages of this post-dystopian world where communication is completely cut off and people are living in small villages. And this group of actors go from town to town and they bring the entertainment, and it's all Shakespeare. So they all have all of Shakespeare memorized, and some of it's very, very funny, and of course some of it's not because it's set in a post-apocalyptic world. But I loved it, and Mike interviewed the author, so I'll let him talk a little bit about her.
Well, it's interesting, she has a background, her previous books had gotten attention. She does literary slash mysteries and literary slash thrillers, and this one is got dubbed literary slash dystopian. And so what's interesting to me is that to see the rest of the fiction reading world catching up to what had been kind of this tiny little, this growing corner, but you used to put all the books about the end of the world on one shelf, and now it's spreading out into the rest of it. I think what caught people's attention about that one is that it's, as much of that book as is set in this, a future where where a killer virus has wiped out most of humanity. A good portion of the book is set in the world before that, and she writes equally well in both parts. And I think that's maybe what caught the critical establishment's attention. But it's also a fun read. And I was, fun is the wrong word. It's also an interesting read, and it keeps you going. And as my friends know, I was just happy to see that Star Trek survives the end of the world, that these people
yes,
are driven forward
exactly
by a quote from a Star Trek episode.
Survival is insufficient.
Survival is insufficient. Mm-hmm. And,
which is kind of a nice way to approach the arts. It's too bad that it comes from Star Trek because it makes it seem like a kind of a silly quote, but it's great.
Well, and I think maybe if you want to talk about the publishing in general or about books in general, maybe there's something that's resonated with people who love books that stuck with them, because we've come off a couple of really scary years where, a couple of years ago during the recession and when people didn't know what ebooks were going to do, it's like people were wondering what's happening with reading, what's happening with books. And as we're gathered here and people are listening to us understand, I don't think they're going to go away. I think that survival is insufficient, and there's a basic human need to have books like that and books like we're talking about and conversations like we're having right now.
We're speaking this hour with Mike Murschel and Joy Tipping of the book section of the Dallas Morning News, and with Randy Mayu, a speaker, writer, and host of the First Friday Book Synopsis series, about some of the most interesting books of 2014. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for January to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking about some of the most interesting books of 2014 with Joy Tipping, who is a book reviewer for the Dallas Morning News, Michael Marshall, who is books editor for the Dallas Morning News, and Brandy Mayu, a speaker, writer, and host of the First Friday Book Synopsis series, which focuses on business bestsellers. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. Just to know, do you guys have, has everyone embraced the idea of books in digital form? How do y'all feel about this?
I was very, very reluctant to embrace that. And I did finally buy a Kindle, which I found too small for my needs. And I've upgraded to an iPad, mostly because there is a wonderful app called Next Issue for magazines.
Yeah.
And I am a total magazine junkie, so I'm probably saving at least 100 trees a year by having Next Issue. But I do find myself reading books on that on planes. And when I travel, I just take that now. But it took me a long time to get to that point. I really still love having a physical book in front of me. I love that smell of when I crack a new book. There's nothing better to me than going into a used bookstore and that smell wafting over you. And I just like the physical feel of it. I actually have a stack of old paperbacks that I call bathtub books that I read in the bathtub. So if I drop them, it doesn't matter. But I also, when I'm reviewing, I like to use sticky notes. And I'm one of those people who can't write in a book. It's like physically impossible for me to write in a book. But I do completely go crazy with the sticky notes when I'm reviewing. And my husband says that he can tell how much I loved a book or hated a book by the exuberance or lack thereof of the sticky note collection. So I was a little bit reluctant, but I'm coming around.
I am a total convert to the Kindle app on my iPad. I still read my Nero Wolfe books. I've got the whole corpus in physical form. But one of the things that I do is I buy the business books. They're not available at the library, but I can check out and get within 30 seconds a Kindle app book from the Richardson Library, and I also have a Garland Library card. So that's saving me a lot of money, and I just love the Kindle app. For me, I can highlight excerpts of the book, you know, like you used to underline, and it becomes available online to me, and I can copy and paste. That's an important part of how I use books. So I'm a Kindle app fan.
Yeah, no offense to all the users of Kindles, Nooks.
You're talking to an old
Kobos.
Newspaper guy here.
I still read with a pencil in my hand, and I have a. I've done reading on my iPad, and I found it convenient, especially while flying. The couple books I've reviewed, I've done on planes like that. But I've read that there is something they're finding that your brain actually processes information differently when you get it from a screen than when you get it from a page. And I actually think I retain stuff better when I see it ink on paper. It's entirely possible that a generation growing up with words on a screen might go the opposite for them, but I know who I am and give me the paper.
Own that. You said, Mike, that one of the best books you've ever read about Dallas history came out this year, and that was Doug Swanson's Blood Aces, the Benny Binion story.
Yeah, and I have to qualify that by saying I know Doug, and I've edited him before, so he's not a stranger, but I came to this book reluctantly. I've read about Dallas history. I thought I knew Dallas history. I'm not that interested in gangsters. I don't go to Las Vegas. But I knew the guy who wrote it, and I assigned it to a critic, Alan Barra, who is in New Jersey, and he wrote this gushing review.
The book really does draw you in.
It does. And so I said, okay, well, I guess just because I have to face Doug in the hallways, I better read it. And it's fantastic. It completely converted me almost from the first page. It feels like a thriller. It reads more like a thriller or a cops and robbers type.
True crime.
Yeah,
well, it is true crime, I guess.
Yeah, it reads more like fiction than it does like history. And to find out stuff that went on right here in Dallas, to find out, that it was, a wide open city basically and completely corrupt and the, the people being gunned down on the street in broad daylight. And then it all up and moved to Las Vegas and, It's really a wonderful read. If you have any sense of history, if any of those things that we just mentioned even interest you in the slightest, I would recommend that one.
I would ditto that, and I'm thoroughly expecting HBO to option it, and you know, Doug is going to be a gazillionaire and leave us, and that will be very sad. But it's that good a book. It's probably my favorite nonfiction book of the year. And I'm like Mike, I don't gamble. I really had no interest in it. And when I saw it, I thought, oh God, I'm going to have to read this because Doug wrote it, and he's one of my writing idols. But oh, it's a great ride.
Randy, I know you're a great friend and fan of Lawrence Wright. Did you happen to read? Have you gotten to 13 Days in September yet?
I have not gotten to that yet, but you're right. I'm a big fan of Lawrence Wright, and I still think that one of the things we ought to do is go back to his Looming Tower, the Pulitzer Prize winner, just to understand Al-Qaeda and the background behind this entire new world to us. But it's on my list. I haven't gotten to it yet, and so I apologize.
No, don't apologize. There's a lot to read. One of the books that you really liked this year was Accelerate, which if people are looking for it, I guess they had the good sense to put XLR8, but then next to it is the word, so it's Googleable.
That's right. Let me just comment that everybody's trying to figure out how to stay innovative. And the innovators pointed this out, but what happens is the larger a company gets, the more likely it is that they will quit innovating. And so what John Kotter did in Accelerate, and there are really about five books that go together, 0 to 1, Accelerate, the Second Machine Age, talking about this new era of what we have to do. Kotter says that you've got to have a side group. We used to call these skunk works. You've got to have a side group that functions like a network instead of a hierarchy. And Accelerate, the full title is Building Strategic Ability for a Faster Moving World, is the idea of how to create an organizational structure that still allows for perpetual innovation. It's a very good book. I think one of the must reads for people who do innovation.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak with Tim in Louisville. Sounds like you might be on the road. Tim, hi.
Yes, I am. Thank you. I want to say you're the young Diane Reed, and that's high praise.
Well, thank you.
I really enjoy your interviews.
Thank you.
I just finished the Ken Follett trilogy, Century trilogy. I'm constantly looking for a new book. You guys find obviously the thousands and thousands of books that are out there that fall into the market. And what do you consider literary? Why do you choose one over another? I read one just recently called The 15th Life of Harry August, which I thought was absolutely wonderful, but I don't see it many other places. Why do you get on something to review? What's the purpose?
Great question. We could fill the rest of the hour with it, but we'll see if we can get an answer for you in a couple of minutes here.
I can give kind of a short answer, I think, because I think he has a point in it is kind of an arbitrary label, and I don't think it's a fair one. There are some books that are very specifically, they get labeled genre books, you know, mysteries and science fiction, and they tend to be, you know, like I said, shoved away into one corner, and the assumption is that nobody will go and read that, you know, unless you're into that type of book. And it's really kind of a made-up label. I mean, you could go, you know, the Emily St. John Mandel, we talked about that earlier, there's a book that is got the label of literary / science fiction. There's another one, California, which is the Eden Lupuki. Is that how you say her name?
I think so, yes.
Got attention from Stephen Colbert this year. That got also that label, literary / science fiction. That / I think is going to go away, I hope, someday soon. I hope that people can just appreciate good writing when it's good writing. There is bad literary writing, there is bad genre writing. And I think the caller seems to have a particular genre that he likes, and that's great. And I, you know, would hope that, you know, I hope that everybody can find, you know, can branch. He doesn't have to feel pushed into a corner like that. Do you have any recommendations for him, Joy?
I do, actually, because I love Ken Follett, too. I'm more of a fan of his older stuff. Eye of the Needle is one of my favorite books ever, The Key to Rebecca. Those are older books. But I love what I would call literary thrillers and literary mysteries. And again, I kind of hate to use that term literary because I think some of the best writing out there comes from those genres. Dennis Lehane is brilliant. He wrote Mystic River and Shutter Island, which I believe is coming to HBO soon. I may be wrong about the network, but it's being made into a miniseries or a show. And James Lee Burke, who wrote the Dave Robichaux novels that are set in Louisiana. He also has a series set in Texas that I haven't read yet. I think a great example of somebody who broke out of that genre classification is Diana Gabaldon, who wrote the Outlander series, which has come to a lot of people's attention this year because of the Starz series, which was a big hit. Before that, her books always made the bestseller list, but for some reason it was either you were a Diana Gabaldon fanatic or you had never heard of the books.
These are like time-traveling books.
And they are. And when she first published, they were published as romance, and she was furious because romance was sort of the ghetto genre back then in the early 90s when Outlander first came out. And she fought and fought and fought to get those books placed within the regular fiction section of bookstores. And when I talked to her this year, just not too long ago, maybe within the past year or so, she finally got Barnes & Noble to move them out of romance into general fiction. Because their time travel, their romance, their adventure, some of the parts of the first book especially are very, very dark and brutal, like Game of Thrones brutal. And I was very thrilled that the series has brought people to the books. And Outlander, the first book, there's 8 books now. But the first book went back on the New York Times bestseller list this year after 24 years.
That's quite a feat.
In print, yes.
Joy, 2 things off of what you said. One is you mentioned Dennis Lehane, and we should plug the Arts and Letters Live series in Dallas. It's bringing him to town. Check online. I think it's in April. I may be wrong about that, but fans can look forward to that next year. You reminded me just talking about that one more literary / subject that the caller might be interested in, and this would be this is a fantasy series concluded this year by Lev Grossman called The Magicians. The Magician's Land came out in August. I got to speak with the author earlier in the year. The literary half of it is that he applied basically modernist writing techniques to the fantasy genre. So that makes it safe to discuss with your friends who are English majors. The rest of us can enjoy it because it's a wonderful, fun ride where he drops references to basically every fantasy novel that anybody ever read as a kid. I had given up, probably about the time I turned 15, I'd probably stopped reading fantasy books and considered myself too old for them. When this series came out, it brought me back in a very good way. They're very good books. That's
You know who else is coming into town in the next few months is Peter Mendelsohn, who wrote this amazing book called What We See When We Read. I don't know if any of you have read it, but it's sort of unlike anything I have read before, and it seems like anyone who loves to read will really engage with that book.
He's the book jacket designer,
right.
Correct?
Mm-hmm.
Who did the cover for The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo?
Yes, and the book is sort of this like really interesting just examination of the pictures we make in our head, something that even I think a lot of avid readers haven't thought much about. And the way that we fill in details as the books go on, and there's a lot of illustrations within the book, and it's just I would recommend it.
I would say one of my favorite books this year was Amy Bloom's Lucky Us, mm-hmm. and in that review that I did, I actually mentioned the book design, the cover design, which is something I had never done before, but I thought it was so perfect. It so perfectly captured the book that I did mention it. So I think it's becoming more and more important as our minds are polluted and crowded by so many things, so many images more than ever with social media. And, there's so much to look at and see, and so many top 50 books that book covers are more and more important to draw you in. And this one was a perfect illustration of what the book was about. So, and I think the New York Times actually has come out with, and this is the first time I've seen it. They may have done it before, but I saw for the first time this year they had a list of the top 10 book covers. Mm.
That's worth celebrating.
Yeah.
You shouldn't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge the cover on its own merits.
Exactly. Exactly.
All right, let's go back to the phones now. We have Bill on the line in Richardson. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Chris. I'm somewhat of a frequent caller. That obviously, that means I'm a pretty regular listener.
Well, welcome.
Being an English teacher for a number of years, I felt like I was compelled to read the things that I was supposed to read in high school, but when I read them as a teacher, I found that they actually were good. But I wanted to make a plug for people who there's three gentlemen who I really look forward to every book that they release. And similar to the question earlier, there's a gentleman called John Gilstrap and another David Baldacci. And, you know, to me, it's like I cannot wait for one of their books to be released. And John Gilstrap, I only found out about him through an article where David Baldacci recommended him.
It's always interesting the way that can happen sometimes, and you can go on the sort of rabbit trail down to someone that you really love.
Mm-hmm. I'm a fan of David Baldacci as well. He writes thrillers, and that's my thing. I love thrillers. And if you're looking for good thrillers, I would mention one that came out this year by a Texas author, Minerva Koenig, called 9 Days. And I said in my review that I love the Kinsey Millhone books that Sue Grafton has been writing for years and years and years. And they're alphabet mysteries. The first one was A is for Alibi. Well, she's only got 3 letters left of the alphabet. So we're all in sort of pre-mourning what happens when the alphabet series is over. And I believe Sue is in her late 70s now. So I don't think she's going to start another series after that. But Minerva Koenig's book is the first one I've read that had the same kind of feisty, spunky, really not perfect at all heroine. Her name is, it's escaping me right now, but she's a former thief and money launderer who is sent to a fictional small Texas town in the Witness Protection Program. And much like Angela Lansbury's character in Murder, She Wrote, wherever she goes, trouble follows. And as soon as she gets there, there's a murder, and then a severed hand shows up. And she sets it up, the author sets it up perfectly for a sequel, which would have to do with the burial place of Che Guevara. So I highly recommend that book.
We're speaking this hour with Joy Tipping and Michael Marshall of the Dallas Morning News and Brandy Mayu, host of the First Friday Book Synopsis Series. We will come back to the conversation in a moment. Join us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for January to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking about some of the most interesting books of the year with Randy Mayu, who's the speaker, writer, and host of the First Friday Book Synopsis Series. Michael Marshall is with us as well. He's books editor for the Dallas Morning News, and Joy Tipping is here. She's a book reviewer for the Dallas Morning News. If I spoke too quickly earlier, the Doug Swanson book that we were discussing is called Blood Aces. And I want to move on now. Randy, there's a reissue this year that you're really excited about, a book called Business Adventurers.
Warren Buffett said it's the best business book he ever read, and Bill Gates stole his copy of it, and they ended up writing about it. Business Adventures is 12 classic tales from the world of Wall Street by John Brooks. It's good stories written well. And so I learned about price fixing from General Electric. I learned about other bad eras of business decisions. And again, I think that one of the problems is people kind of don't know the past well enough to know the mistakes they're making today have been made before. So that's a valuable book. It was written in 69, reissued, a bestseller this year. And one of my enjoyable reads, which is, I'm sorry to say this, not all business books are written well. And so it was a very enjoyable read, and I enjoyed it, and I think it tells valuable stories.
And we would be remiss if we didn't talk about Lila.
Yes, absolutely. Marilynne Robinson is just a treasure. Her prose is so beautiful. It it's one of those, whenever I read her, I'm constantly reaching for my journal. I have a reading journal. I don't keep a journal, but I keep a book journal. And I write quotes from books that I read into that journal. And I can go back and it just takes me back to where I was at that time. And I'm constantly, I could almost write the whole book in the journal because her prose is just gorgeous. It almost makes you cry. It's just such beautiful reading. And she wrote a wonderful book called Housekeeping, which I believe came out in 1990, was her first novel. And then she didn't write another novel for 24 years. And then she came out with Gilead, which was about a small town preacher, and told from his point of view, he was writing a letter to his son. He knows he's dying, and it's written in the form of a long letter to his son about his life because he knows he's not going to be able to tell the son this story himself. Then the second book of the trilogy was called Home, and it's about some neighbors of the same family. All that time in both of those books, Lila, who is the preacher's 40 years younger wife, who shows up on the doorstep of the church one night in a pouring rain and is later very quickly asked to marry him. She's kind of in the background hovering, and you think of her as the stoic, you know, doesn't say very much, supportive minister's wife. Well, this book is her book, and oh my gosh, is she a surprise. You know, we find out that she's worked as a prostitute. She was a child of the Depression who was abducted/rescued by a woman who then, you know, taught her how to survive. I mean, it sort of goes back to that survival is insufficient. She does everything she can to survive and then some, including marrying a man 40 years older than she is. The book is very dark, but it's also very much a thriller, which is not what people expect from Marilynne Robinson, but one of my favorite books of probably the last 5 years, and it's on everybody's top five list. The other one I would like to mention, because it's a Texas author who is, I think this is her breakout book, Sarah Bird. She's based in Austin, and she's been bubbling along for several years with really good books. But she wrote a book this year called Above the East China Sea. She was a military dependent. She doesn't like the word military brat because she says those kids are the least bratty you will ever find because they learn discipline. But her family was in Okinawa for quite some time, and this book is set in Okinawa, and it's told through the point of view of two teenage girls, one in World War II, who was one of the girls who was forced to go out and work as a camp nurse in horrible, horrible conditions, and one is a contemporary young woman. And it's a beautiful, beautiful book, and I think it will push her, I hope it will push her into that Marilynne Robinson, you know, Donna Tartt literary status, because that's what she deserves when you can write like she can write.
Big debut that everybody or a lot of people have been talking about is the one by Merritt Tierce, Love Me Back, which I originally picked up, Mike Michelle, because she was blurred by Ben Fountain, mm-hmm. who I just have great respect for.
Mm-hmm. Merritt has definitely become a literary rising star here in the Dallas area. The caveat on that book is, you know, you cannot leave it around if you have kids or grandparents or uptight spouses nearby. It's graphic. It's dark.
It's relentless.
It's relentless is the word. I describe it, for those who haven't come across it, it's Cormac McCarthy's The Road set in a Dallas steakhouse.
The book is quite serious. That description is humorous.
It is, and it draws its power from, if you live in Dallas especially, it gave me a look into the a side of the city that does not get written about very often. You know, Merritt's story is she did work in a well-known Dallas restaurant, and even though the book is fiction, it's openly autobiographical fiction, and you get a real look. Again, like with Blood Aces, you get a look at the side a side of the city that that is too little exposed. I would not call it a pick-me-up. It's maybe not a holiday reading material, but it's very well written, and I'm really looking forward to what she does next.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have Karen on the line in Fort Worth. Hey, Karen.
Hey. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I was curious if either of the people they're visiting have read a book by a new author. His name is Austin Aslan. It came out in August of 2014. It's called The Islands at the End of the World, and it's kind of an apocalyptic novel based in Hawaii.
Everybody here is shaking their heads, but thank you for the recommendation. We can take a look for it.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with that. I point out, we get at our office, now, Chris, I'll bet you're like that this year, we get something on the order of 300 books a week coming in, all eager for reviews. And I'm lucky in that I have a bunch of really good freelance writers who are able to read 5 or 6 of them a week, which we put in the Sunday paper, but that leaves an awful lot of good books out there that we don't get to pay attention to. So I'm always happy to take recommendations and look for new things to explore.
Yeah. Do you guys? Go ahead, Joy.
I was just going to say, a lot of people talk about their to be read stack on their nightstand. I have a to be read bookshelf. I mean, a bookcase that's got like 200 books in it and I'll never get through them all, you know. And I'm always taking books home, and we live in an 800 square foot downtown loft. It's like, where are they going? Well, under the bed, you know, in the kitchen cabinets that we don't use. So it's always great, but it's always great to have another one to put on that list.
One of the things that I've wondered about is how many books people actually read. And there's this new report that Kindle and the e-books can measure how far into a book people have gotten. Hmm. There are a lot of unfinished books. But in my research related to business books, the average business person really only reads about one full book a year. And the rest they buy and then they stack up. So we all are living in a world of so many books and so little time.
Do you all give yourselves permission if you are reading a book not for work and it just you can't connect with it? At what point will you say, I got to move on?
50 pages. That's always been my standard, is if it hasn't grabbed me in 50 pages. But now that I'm over 50, I'm subtracting a page for every year that I'm over 50 because time's a wasting.
Right.
So now it's 47 pages, mm-hmm. you know, and I used to be one of those people that felt like if I started a book, I had to finish it. Right. And I have totally gone past that.
Yeah, I'm you're more generous. If I'm not hooked in 3 or 4 pages. And I, you know, I have the freedom to do this because I don't assign myself, unless I've assigned myself a book to actually review. There's too much good stuff out there to waste time on a bad book. And, I'm often struck by how, you know, there are a lot of really good, well raved about books that I've picked up with full intention of diving into that I find unreadable. But I guess that's just because reading is such a personal thing.
Yeah, I have a couple of authors who shall remain nameless that are huge bestsellers that I have tried multiple times. And I always end up thinking I'm working too hard,
right?
Because I should just be writing this stuff because it's so bad and it sells so well. And I just don't understand it.
The Kindle app sample pages is almost the perfect length for me. It's enough pages to tell me.
A free taste of what you're going to get.
It's free taste. Mm-hmm. And so it gives me enough of the introduction. I can tell, is this going to be valuable? And I have done more and more books that are nonfiction and even a handful of novels with sample pages and ended up reading some. So I used to go to a bookstore and just sit there for 2 hours going through books. Now I can do it with my sample pages.
Any book club recommendations from the last year or so that would be good for good conversation fodder? Any thoughts?
Well, I immediately thought of The Goldfinch, but I think that actually came out last year. I do think Above the East China Sea is a great book club book.
I love The Goldfinch, too.
I love The Goldfinch was just amazing. And Donna Tartt is one of those writers, you know, she writes a book every 10 years. But
it takes about that long to read one, too.
Yes, exactly. But it's so worth it when they come out. Mm-hmm. That we talked about The Invention of Wings just a little bit earlier, and that was, I believe, Amazon's best-selling book of the year. It had the Oprah endorsement, and it's a great book to start a conversation because it's it's sort of wrapped in the gauze of race. Because it's about a young woman who we first meet when she's 11 years old, and she's really progressive, but she's given a slave for her 11th birthday, wrapped in lavender ribbons, and she's horrified, and she writes a letter of of giving the slave her freedom. She writes that letter at 11, and her parents override her, and she has to accept this girl who's her same age. So they grow up together, and they become fast friends, but it's always with that tinge of, here's one human who legally owns another. And so it's a friendship warped by that. But it's really more about friendship and love than it is about slavery and race relations, although there is that element to it. So it's a great book. I think it's a great book for book clubs because it'll inspire a lot of discussion about a lot of different things.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. But, you know, I said that, and I'm not sure we have time to take any more calls. But what's on the list? I know that you guys get the kind of previews. Is there anything that you know will be hitting your desk, your office, in the next couple of months that you're excited to see?
Go ahead. I'll start. I just yesterday they set a release date. Judy Blum has a new novel for adults coming out in June. Toni Morrison has a new novel. That will definitely be an event. I believe that's in April. Those are two of the big ones for the first half of the year, and that should have everybody who's ever picked up a book salivating, because I can't imagine anybody disliking either of those authors.
Yes. I would say, and I'm embarrassed that I can't think of the author's name, and I didn't bring this with me, but there is a thriller coming out in January called The Jaguar's Children, and I believe it's a debut. And just from reading the press release that I was sent, I haven't seen the book yet, but just the press release is making me sort of drum my fingers, you know, waiting to get that book in my hands. And like I said, I'm sorry I can't tell you the author's name, but it's called The Jaguar's Children.
A new book just came out by Salim Ismail. He is the global ambassador for Singularity University, the Ray Kurzweil Group.
Right.
It's called Exponential Organizations. He has given a talk at one of the TED conferences, but one of the specialty TED conferences. Basically, we're all trying to figure out what kind of organization will survive in the future, and this book talks about exponential organizations. I'll be presenting that in January. Pretty excited about it.
It's always exciting that there are big books coming out. Is it John Vallant? Is that the Jaguar's Children author?
Yes,
okay,
that is.
I might be pronouncing the name. V-A-I-L-L-A-N-T. You know, I just want to say it's nice to have a conversation with people who love books. Everybody predicts the demise of the publishing industry, and I think it's going to look really different, but I don't think people's love of reading is going away.
I get too many people come up to me at events who basically start genuflecting and expressing gratitude. It has nothing to do with me, as much as I'd like to think that. It's because they love books, and they're all kinds of people, and people are deeply, deeply passionate about it. I think I get that. I'm sure you get that because you have so many of these fantastic authors on this very program, and it's a privilege to get to work with them, and it's also a joy. Just deep down in your heart, there is nothing that is more exciting or better than getting to spend time with a great book.
Right.
We'll have to leave it at that because we are out of time. Michael Marshall is books editor for the Dallas Morning News. Joy Tipping is a book reviewer for the Dallas Morning News. Randy Mayu is a professional speaker and writer and host of the First Friday Book Synopsis series. It's been so nice to have all of you with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you
so much.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer with help on the phones today from Christina Ulsh. This will be her last day, and we've loved having her with us as an intern. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.